Oh, come on. Everything this government has to do, we met with, oh my god, look what the Tories are doing now. I just wonder what the Labour Party would be doing. It was, after all, them that emptied the pot. Or are we all forgetting we are skint? We are overcrowded, a failed multinational society, and the target of half the world claiming benefits from us. If we stopped that, maybe they could have a biscuit with the milk. On the other hand, if the politicians took a pay cut, that may help and stop the subsidies to Westminster. Our thanks from Sylvia D from the BBC Have Your Say board for that wonderful insight into our nation today. Hello and welcome to Soulbox Radio 2.0, recording on the 10th of August 2010. And with me today is David, editor of the Daily Soapbox, and Johan, an informed guest, and of course myself, Stephen. So, let's start off with Dragon's Corner. This is the part of our podcast where we are looking at an idea our esteemed guest brings to us, and we'll be discussing the implications of this policy and what effects it could have, and whether we agree with it. So, Johan, if you're ready, your 60 seconds begins now.
Yes, when I came to England 2 years ago to study there, I remember I always got into discussions with David about smacking, and what I call beating, he calls it smacking, the way that you in Britain and many other parts of the world still thinks that it's fine to use violence towards children to raise them, which I think it will always be counterproductive, and I think that it's a way of sending signals about violence, etc., etc., to kids. I think you'll get what I mean. And then we discussed other things, and we always discussed these smoking bans on pubs, etc. And then I got this great slogan, which was, ban smacking, not smoking. Because even if, for instance, I understand why you should forbid or why government want to reduce smoking, I thought it was an interesting thing that that's considered as much more a problem, and from moral perspectives, a problem, than that you raise childs or using violence towards children. I think it has many implications.
Okay, we're going to stop you there, Johan. Your 60 seconds are slightly more than over. Stephen, what do you make of that?
Well, I've always been quite opposed to violence, obviously, and it certainly does send out a bad signal. I totally agree with Johan that we're raising our children through violence as opposed to other means. And I remember reading this study report which says that any violence against a child, smacking, is no more effective at disciplining the child than any other forms of discipline, such as just taking away privileges. So I'm quite in favour of this idea.
It was nice to hear someone spontaneously agreeing.
Yes, I mean, my own personal opinion is that it would be stronger to have someone spontaneously agreeing if there was any particular evidence to corroborate it. It's interesting that you bring up this report, Stephen, that you said showed cast doubt on the idea of this being an effective discipline method. But certainly, to look on the flip side of it, the ban in Sweden doesn't appear to have actually had any effect on child abuse. It doesn't appear to have decreased it. In fact, it's probably not a causation, merely a correlation, but since the ban was introduced, apparently, child abuse has actually been on the increase in Sweden. At least that's...
Where do you get that from?
I can't actually cite it, I'm afraid, but it was a report which my mum directed me to a while back. I will try and find it for later.
You might be right. You might very well be right. But the interesting thing is, do you think that the fact that you use smacking in Britain have reduced the amount or diminished the amount of child abuse you would have had if it was not allowed?
Well, you could certainly argue that it gives the police more flexibility into what they treat as a child abuse case and what they don't. As in, it gives more room for the police to use their common sense, as it were.
Yes, that's probably right. But after all, we must not get into the discussion about, like, policemen and, you know, because that's not the point. The main point is the attitude and how we think about something like this.
Well, in my point of view, okay, I've seen many examples of parents chastising their children outside in public, and I can nearly always say that it strikes me as more disturbing when you see parents sort of losing it and yelling at their children, losing control verbally, than when you see parents disciplining through, say, a smack. Because I think it almost there's something in us which reacts even more badly towards the attitude of a parent being visibly angry with us verbally than the short, sharp signal that you've done something wrong, and then that's over.
I can't say I agree with you there, David, because I think Johan does have a point. In what we're saying by banning smacking is we're trying to change society's attitude towards violence and towards acceptance that you can use violence to solve certain problems, which is simply untrue. Violence is never a solution.
Oh, no, that's not true. I'm sorry, you're begging a very big question there. I don't think there's a single period in the history of the human race where violence has not been used as a solution to certain things. It's often backfired, certainly, but I think it is begging the question, if violence never works as a solution, then why has it always been with us? Why
but the problem is
continue?
That all the solutions that humanity comes up with never seem to work, and there might be a link there between that actually we use violence to solve things, but they never get solved because this chain always goes on because of the nature of violence itself and following revenge.
I also think that you're undervaluing the seriousness of non-physical violence. And
that's true.
I mean, again, I go back to my point that the discipline I received, for example, as a child, strikes me as far less violent than the way I see sometimes see parents going crazy in front of their children. And I'm sorry, but of course we can never see what a world without violence would be like, because it's a fundamental part of human nature which will never go away. But I certainly think that for that reason you shouldn't bring children up to think that violence is never a solution, because that's actually going to be a very silly attitude to take in the real world. And as you know, when you're raising children, you are preparing them for the real world.
And is preparing them for the real world done by smacking them or hitting them? I find that hard to believe, to be honest. And I think the world would be a better place if we didn't do that. And if we really taught our children, hang on, let's not use violence. Let's find other ways that don't involve physical harm to get to our solution, then it would be better. And I'm firmly in Johan's camp at this point, to be honest.
Well, I really don't see it. I think you're making a very big deal out of the physical implications of smacking and ignoring the far more serious question of the actual attitude. And to my mind, there's no correlation between a bad attitude towards children and whether parents smack or not.
Absolutely not. And that's not really what I tried to say.
But essentially,
what I meant, that I'm not meaning that that's the case, as you just said. And I think I personally sometimes underestimate the bad part of you know, screaming at kids and stuff. But it's just that it's still an expression for an attitude, and it's still an expression for a way of thinking, which to me is, so to say, slightly on the wrong track. And I don't mean that, for instance, smacking or using smacking will be, you know, in individual cases better or worse or anything. But as I said, the main point is the attitude.
I get the impression here that you're making this, barking down the wrong tree in exactly the same way that anarchists do when they talk about the state being founded upon violence. You're saying that violence is bad, which as a general rule it is, ergo, smacking is always bad. I think it's the same way of saying violence is bad, ergo, the state is always bad. It's not the case, and I think ultimately in our life we have not yet reached a stage, I don't believe we ever will, where society can function without the implicit threat of violence when things go wrong. And again, I don't want to raise, if I ever have my own children, them to believe that violence is always wrong, because that I feel would be counterproductive. And I also believe there are situations, I firmly believe this, where it sends a far better signal to get discipline over with quickly, like that. For instance, if a child runs out into a road and you only just get to them in time, stuff like that. I think there is a part of us which intuitively responds far more efficiently to this form of discipline. And again, even discounting that, I'm going to go back to where I'm strongest arguing, which is simply in terms of pragmatism, because what you seem to be arguing for is a policy which makes no sense, because firstly, it doesn't reflect on whether the parents are good parents. I believe there is no correlation. Secondly, it is impossible to enforce properly. Essentially,
well,
I do not see
what... Well, you could say that about any law then, in a way.
No, many laws are perfectly easy to enforce, but enforcing the ban on smacking, to my mind, would actually be counterproductive. So what's the point of having it? I mean, you have many focus groups already for you to condemn the practice, and I think people can make up their own minds.
I don't think we're being completely naive when we say violence is bad. I think generally violence is bad, but that's not to say sometimes violence isn't necessary. I'm a believer in the just war theory. I think at times we do need to use violence when all other options have run out or we have no choice. But I don't think that choice exists when it comes to disciplining children. I think you're making a forced dilemma when you say either we have to smack our children or we just shout or scream at them. That's not true. There are other forms of discipline, such as taking away privileges. And when you say the enforcement is very difficult...
Well, just to go back to your point about am I creating a false dilemma and there never being a case where violence is the ultimate thing you need to use as discipline, I think it is impossible for us to say that categorically until we have had children, which places rather a barrier to us discussing the matter in any more depth, unfortunately.
Well, I'm not sure. My brother is 9. And I was 12 when he was born, so I have followed him.
Yes, but you haven't been responsible for him in the same way. Your parents
no,
have.
That's true. That's true. But I have been able to do some observations. To say what I realized afterwards was that raising a child was never as easy as I always thought it was before I saw a child grow up.
Yes, but
because I was convinced it was very easy and that all parents that shouted at their kids were just stupid. But I realized that it's not as easy when I saw it with my own
eyes. So you're backing up my point there?
Yes, I'm trying to be open-minded about your arguments.
My own belief is that it would be extremely foolish of me to categorically state that there would never be a situation where physical discipline would not be the best one. But of course, we can all compare notes in 20 years' time when we're graying and have 5 children or whatever.
At that time, it might be too late.
You mean we might be convicts under the exported Swedish smacking ban, which has now reached England? Could be. But in any case, hopefully, Johan Löfving will not become a politician here anytime soon. Apologies.
Probably not.
So, Stephen, what do you think about the state we're in, as in the next section of this podcast? What do you think have been the highlights of this week?
Well, I'm going to open up with a bit of a different one. It's not exactly a mainstream news story, but I'm not sure if either of you two have heard of the latest Eminem single, The Way You Lie. And there's been a music video released for it now, which depicts rather strongly the cycle of domestic abuse between a couple. And the song also depicts very strongly in lyrical terms the nature of domestic abuse and the harm and so on. Now, the music video has come under a lot of controversy for showing so powerfully and realistically domestic abuse. And some say Eminem's song has actually glamorized domestic abuse. Now, I'm wondering what you two think about this, whether certain forms of music or art which depict stuff like domestic abuse or violence are bad and should be banned, or whether it's a good part of our society and culture to have these go on.
I think I'm at a disadvantage here, having not seen or heard the song. I don't know whether you have,
Johan. No.
I suspected not somehow. I don't know. I mean, the only thing I can really say here is to draw a distinction. You said, is this a good thing to highlight this or a bad thing and should be banned? I mean, even if it was a bad thing, I think you would have to go a lot further before you said that there should be censorship of music and this of media in general. I don't know. It all depends on the context. Unfortunately, this is a case where a woman had to see the song. I mean, obviously, you don't want to censor all attempts to draw awareness to domestic violence, but I can't really say much more than that, I'm afraid.
I definitely agree with you there, because no matter how bad it is, you will have to go probably very, very far before you can forbid or censor artworks or anything like that. Because, I mean, as you I haven't seen this either, but there are lots of, you know, the so-called fine, distinguished culture, which deals with very uncomfortable issues in a very bad way. I mean, just take the way as Wagner operas is inspired by his very anti-Semitic ideas, for instance. And I mean, there are lots of things like that. And then you have to say, well, should we forbid this or ban this and so on? I think even if this video seems to be expressing something very bad, I guess you can't really forbid. I mean, it would have to be something rather exceptional.
I think there is a innate tendency in all of us to, whenever we see something we dislike, think of what can be done to prevent this from happening. And sometimes that works, but other times it doesn't. Other times it leads us to what I consider sort of the banning urge. Everyone has something or other. They instinctively say that I want to see that banned. But it's really something which you have to be very, very cautious about.
That's interesting, because my initial reactions to seeing this, the music video and hearing the song and learning about the debate was, you know, this is a really good thing, actually, and we should try to encourage as much of this as possible. And it's interesting you two come from the angle of, you know, we should try to prevent a banning, whereas I'm coming more from, let's try to encourage this and open it up more, because the highlight of this issue, domestic abuse, in this way, and the discussion it provokes and emerges, I think is a very good thing. And if we had more art like this, I think our society would be a lot more healthy, and the openness to discuss issues like this would be much better done.
Well, I mean, just to clarify something, I wasn't taking that particular angle, but you have an advantage here, because I haven't seen this, and neither has Johan, so it's a bit difficult for us to say this is something which we should have more of if we haven't seen it. So.
But what do you mean with having a more healthy attitude or discussing this in a more healthy way?
I think our society, our culture, the British culture, has a bit of a tendency to not delve too deeply into personal problems like domestic abuse. I think we have a bit of a history of keeping things like that very private and not discussed openly or publicly.
Can you really say that anymore? I mean, we've had things like Coronation Street and EastEnders for decades, and there seem to be whole magazines devoted to discussing the inner problems of people's lives. I'm not sure that you can really apply the national stereotype in the same way you used to be able to.
So, Johan, do you have any particular state we're in news story to talk to us about?
No, I don't think so, actually. I mean, it's the same thing here in Sweden going on about this election and discussing here and there, and all the party leaders try to give their last-minute election promise. And I don't think any of it seems to be very serious in the end. I think people, in the end, we will see an election which expresses which of the two main party leaders that are most popular, simply. Just a bit like you, David, used to complain about, that we get an Americanized view on our political parties, so that the leaders get more important than the actual issues.
Yes, I mean, I did actually change my mind on that when it looked like Nick Clegg was genuinely enjoying a boost in the polls, but he didn't. It was all a false illusion. So, yes, I'm still anti-leaders debates. But I've got something here which you would find interesting, Johan. It's a headline on BBC News. It's called EU Considers Levying Taxes Directly. And we all know how much you love the EU. So it says underneath, the European Commission wants EU member states to consider allowing it to levy direct taxes, a move that could ease the burden on national budgets, apparently. the EU's budget commissioner said he would present some options next month for direct EU taxes. So is this the final step towards a European superstate?
So this means he wants to have a unified, more or less unified tax system?
Well, it's certainly the idea is for them to levy taxes directly. How much taxes is a question, of course.
I just think it's a very dangerous development. It's not very easy to say anything about it, because I still think we are so far from, I mean, the people that are governing and these commissioners, they know, I mean, seriously, they know nothing about the individual countries. Each commissioner only know about one country, and that's the country they come from or have lived in for a longer time. I mean, countries and nations are much more complex mechanisms than something you can just read about on Wikipedia or anything like that. The way that tax systems and the way that the general economy in the different nations is a result of hundreds of years of traditions and development and culture, which can't just be translated into some EU document with some, you know, signatures from some, you know, prime minister, you know, some wannabe king, you know, it's just ridiculous.
Okay, well, I've lit the blue touch paper, so I'll stand well back. Stephen, have you anything to reply to that?
Well, I have to say, I'm cautiously optimistic. I haven't heard this yet, but I think I would be fairly in favour of something like a direct EU levy. I mean, I presume this is going to be a separate tax to the ones we pay to our current government. So there'll be another tax where we pay an extra something like 5 or 10% a year, something like that, directly to the EU. I think this would be a generally positive step towards creating a unified European Union. I think this would give people a stronger sense of a stakehold in the European ideal. I think people will feel more passionate about what things the European Union spends its money. I think people will start thinking themselves as European, and not just British or German or Swedish or whatever. So I'm cautiously optimistic. I'm going to wait to see what the direct proposal is, of course. But
well, I can tell you more, but actually I'll link you to it. But firstly, it doesn't say income taxes directly, which would kind of undermine the argument about there being a more direct link between the people and the EU. It says taxes on aviation, financial transactions and CO2 emission permits are all possibilities. The budget commissioner told Daily Financial Times Deutschland. And I have to admit here, I'm being a bit naughty because I haven't told you that the next line states, however, the UK promptly rejected the idea, which isn't exactly surprising, is it? But it is interesting. I mean, it would be interesting for the EU to have to rely on direct taxation from member states. It would certainly make it less easy to disguise its budget sort of general air of mystery. It might increase pressure for it to account properly for the money it uses. But that, I think that would only really hold true if it was a direct tax on per capita rather than one on indirect things as well, such as business practices and financial transactions.
I haven't had to skim through that. I realise it's not per capita, which is okay, because even if the EU is getting tax directly from these other areas like aviation, financial transactions and CO2 emissions, I think it would be better if the EU did have a less of a reliance on national governments, because I would see the EU as a check to the sort of nationalistic, self-interested idea that governments are going by.
Well, it is interesting that a large part of the EU is actually intergovernmental. So a lot of the things that are commonly blamed on the European Union are actually things governments have been quite happy to vote for.
May I just say something here? That I have to say that, I mean, I don't really want to express some kind of old-fashioned nationalism which put the national state above everything else, because, first of all, we are humans. And, I mean, that doesn't matter. I mean, the most important is, we know what it says in the Beethoven's Last Symphony, that we are all brothers. But the thing is that the European Union is more and more getting an expression for this kind of, yeah, not nationalism, but the sense that we, a specific group of relatively rich white people in the Northern Europe, we have this little elite club. And suddenly I'm striking this from a rather left-wing perspective, but Actually, I think that's a new form of nationalism, governed by you know, the big companies and governed by money most of all. No, and I think that's the new great danger. I mean, an EU army, EU interventing around the world, spreading war just like the US does.
I think actually an irony is that the more the EU is, say, agreed intergovernmentally, so as sort of, the more it's sort of governed between national states, the more likely it is for it to be something of a club. So if you devolve power directly back to the people, say with more direct taxation and also more direct electing, it might actually decrease that. But the other thing is, this is more of a technical sort of criticism, but the other thing I would say about direct EU taxation is that it could lead to rather arbitrary developments so long as national governments still have control over things like interest rates. Because then say, you could get taxes increasing sharply for a country because of a change in monetary policy. Say that the pound were to fall against the euro, then suddenly Britain's taxes might go up quite considerably. I think that's the way it would work. I think, essentially, there's a long way to go before anything like this is possible. The first thing that needs to happen in order for people to actually believe in European political union would be for it to become much more democratic. And unfortunately, at the moment, that appears to be a long way from the agenda.
I certainly agree with you, David. And the point you made about how a change in the interest rates could affect differing nation states and so on, it's just another argument, I think, for more monetary union and for us to abandon the pound and enter the euro. It just makes as much sense as that. I have to disagree, though, with Johan about this idea of the Europeanism being the new nationalism. I don't quite see that happening because Europe has a very divided history. And if the different European nations, which have for so long been fighting against each other, in so many different wars, can come together, put aside their differences, and create a really unified force, then I would say anything would be possible from then on.
The thing is that, let's say you would be right on that point, but then you have the next problem, and that's the one where we always say that, oh, this brings us closer to each other, and opening borders makes us, you know, feeling more closely related to our neighbors, etc. But what I'm afraid is that this is still a development only for those middle class, the middle class which has money enough to use this. And actually, the unifying of the united people of Europe is more and more the united people who have money enough to be united.
That's an interesting problem, but it's an interesting idea, but I'm not quite sure I agree with you there, because a lot of the beneficiaries, say, of freedom of movement have actually been very poor. And I know that because I live in Leinster, and there's a lot of Romanian, Bulgarian
workers. Yes, but what has that led to? That has led to that the working class in the other countries has become upset about losing their job opportunities, and instead of unifying people, that has created a conflict. So that means that while the middle and upper classes are getting more unified, the lower classes are getting more into conflict with each other.
But only in Britain, though. Only in Britain.
No, everywhere.
No, seriously.
Sweden is a great example.
No, because
we have had many conflicts. Yeah, sorry.
Was it in Poland that the president recently spoke very favourably of the practice of their nationals to go and take advantage of freedom of work and freedom of movement and work in other member states? I mean, that's an example of a policy benefiting the poor in Europe who take advantage of it. And of course, it causes localised tensions sometimes. But I think if you were to look at the aggregate, if you were to look at the poor in Europe generally, you could find that it's actually made their lives easier. If you think about it, the fact that someone in most EU member states has the freedom not only to go and work in another country, but to enjoy full working rights when he goes there. And that's the important thing. Someone can move to England and do a job, but they also have the right to seek another job. So therefore, they have full bargaining rights and can actually strike the best deal possible for themselves. And that wasn't possible before. And what you'll find, and this has definitely happened in Leinster, is that those countries which aren't allowed full freedom of movement, such as Bulgaria and Romania, actually end up with their workers suffering a lot more. And that actually has the effect of driving wages for the poorest workers in this country down, because the companies aren't afraid to offer cheaper wages to workers who have limited working rights in this country.
It's interesting you brought up the idea of bargaining rights there, David, because from what I've studied on the European Union, collective bargaining rights by the former trade unions has weakened, really, under the European Union. For example, there is a very weak European trade union, which is meant to work cross nations, cross borders. And so I'm not sure workers' rights have really improved that much since the European Union came about.
Well, I think that was true at one point, certainly, in the late 1980s, before we signed the social chapter, and when the EU legislation actually prohibited the closed shop, which is now illegal in the UK, if I remember this correctly. But certainly now, actually, I suspect that legislation such as the Human Rights Act and other EU regulations grant better protection to UK workers and to trade unions than our own law does. You might not have noticed this in the last year or so, but the regulations concerning the calling of strikes in this country are very, very tight. And that's why you've seen a lot of strikes banned in the UK recently, or declared illegal, which has happened to BA and Unite recently. So I'm not convinced by that suggestion.
But the problem is the weakness of a European trade union. Can you name the European trade union?
But that's more to do with the level people form unions at, which is still very much in jobs within member states. European-wide trade unions are probably not going to become very common until you have much further social and political union, surely. I think it's probably time to move on from this discussion in general. And we've been going on quite long, so I think we'll wrap it up here. Stephen has some kind of amusing quote for us to ruminate over. Go ahead, Stephen.
Okay, so who said this and what was it about? I don't really think there's any risk of my becoming homogenized or lobotomized.
I have no idea what it's about, but I'm guessing Mandelson.
Any ideas, Johan?
No, I'm not into British, the intimate parts of British policy enough.
Oh, that's a shame.
Who was it?
It was Boris Johnson talking
actually, yeah,
to the mayor of London. And he says, I don't really think there's any risk of my becoming homogenized or lobotomized.
And what was this about?
He was talking about how he's changed since becoming the mayor of London. It was an interview with the Daily Mail. And there are some tidbits in there about Boris Johnson eventually going for the lead of the Conservative Party and their premiership. But I hope we're a long way from that.
Oh, is that what he was referring to? Does he believe that becoming leader of the Conservative Party entails becoming homogenized and lobotomized?
I don't think so.
Oh, well, pity. Anyway, I think that pretty much sums it up. So this is David Webber signing off.
Stephen One going to bed.
And Johan Lovewing says bye-bye.